Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm Mike Kalichman. I'm the director for the Research Ethics Program and a professor at UC San Diego. Tonight's program, as I suspect most, if not all of you know, is part of an ongoing series. It's the fourth in a series of talks that we're calling the Henrietta Lacks Series. And just to get a quick gauge of where we are, how many of you attended the talk by Rebecca Skloot in November? It looks like almost everybody did, so you are continuing on because of this. Before I introduce the moderator to begin tonight's program, I want to give all of you, especially those of you who are newer to the program and series, some context for what we're doing. By using this single book for the year's worth of programs, or 9 months' worth of programs, we've had a chance to connect up with people throughout the community, as you see from the current slide. So all of these different organizations have been involved in trying to look at different ethical dimensions of what happened with the story of Henrietta Lacks. That story has many components to it, and those are reflected in the talks that we have presented by people representing different universities and communities throughout San Diego. Tonight, the fourth program is largely put on through UC San Diego. Not only am I from UC San Diego, but the moderator and speaker for tonight's program are also both from UC San Diego. And tonight's program in some ways may be, in certain ways, one of the most important. The goal is to look at clinical trials, how we do our research, how we study human beings and understand biology and medicine. And what we want to know is, what are the barriers to recruitment to clinical trials? Why don't people enter trials? What are some of the concerns? Some are justified, some aren't. How do we deal with those? Having concluded on that, I want to now introduce Dr. Lyndia Willies, who will be the moderator for tonight's program. I've known Lyndia for many years. She worked in the research area with me and my wife, actually, as it turns out. Lyndia has moved up the ranks. She's a professor in pediatrics, but she's also the assistant dean for diversity and community engagement at UC San Diego. When I was talking to her about this program and realized her own interest in the book, I thought she would be perfect to be the moderator for this evening. So I'm going to invite Lyndia up here now. She'll introduce the speaker, and I will join you again at the end of the program. Thanks.
Great, thank you, and thank you, Mike. I'm going to be brief because Dr. Sadler has quite a treat awaiting us, and you have her bio in front of you, so I will just briefly introduce her to you. Dr. Sadler is the Associate Director for Community Outreach at the Moores UCSD Cancer Center, and she's also a clinical professor at the UCSD Department of Surgery. And Dr. Sadler's sort of work has really been around engagement of community in clinical trials and clinical research, and she has actually worked tirelessly in this particular area. So I do think that we would, without a doubt, consider her an expert in this field and in this area, which is an incredibly important one. So without further ado, I would like to invite Dr. Sadler to join us. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm very impressed. I thought, who's going to come out to hear about clinical trials? But here you are. So thank you for coming. Well, Rebecca Skloot did us a wonderful service because she's put this question before a national audience. And as a result of her efforts, the community is coming forward with an interest in what are clinical trials, what is research. And so tonight, what I wanted to do was to take you through a very quick review of clinical research, what it's all about, but it's going to be fast. I just want to give you the cliff notes, if you will, on clinical trials so that we can get started. I want us all on the same platform to start with as we go forward. So when we talk about clinical trials, we're really talking about exploring the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial. This is not about coercion. This is about opportunities. Opportunities to make a difference. Opportunities to know that if you are from a community, from the African American community, the Asian American community, Hispanic American, Native American, Indian, that you have a chance to experience a new research discovery before we declare that it works or fails to work. So a large piece of research is being sure that everybody is represented. So I wanted to emphasize we're talking about exploring clinical trials and research study opportunities. So then you ask me, what's the biggest barrier to research progress? Why can't we go faster? Good question. It's certainly not from a lack of ideas. I can stand there at the cancer center or in front of the diabetes program or the heart unit, and every scientist who walks in can easily just fly off the handle with 25 great ideas they'd like to research. That's not the problem. Is it money? Well, money is always a problem because there are many, many good ideas, and only the best ones will be funded. And sometimes something that didn't look quite the best doesn't get funded, and in fact, it was a winner. We just couldn't recognize it. So any scientist will tell you, please throw more money at the problem. But the real problem is the time. It's the time it takes to find eligible people. So if you can imagine, we can't just look at a new drug or a new surgical procedure without very narrowly defining who's eligible to participate in that study. So if you're looking at an arthritic joint, and you have a joint for people over the age of 65, you don't want 25-year-olds in the study. It will confuse your discovery. So we get these narrower and narrower eligibility criteria. 65 or older, must have had pain for at least 2 years, could not have had prior certain analgesics, no family history. They'll get a long list because they really want to know, does the intervention in its most purified form work? So the eligibility criteria are not there to keep somebody out. That's not the goal, but they're there to try to get the best possible science we can have. Then we have to find people who are even interested in the study. Well, probably if I asked for a show of hands, which I'm not, how many of you have an arthritic knee and are over the age of 65 and go down my list, and maybe if we were lucky, one of you would raise your hand tonight. One of you. It's the needle in the haystack. And then I have to confirm that you're really eligible. Was it really just 2 years, or have you been suffering for 4 years? Different issues. If you've been suffering for 4 years, you're not eligible. And it's not just that the scientist is being mean. It's that we bow at the worship stand of institutional review boards. And we tell them how we would like to do our science. We give them our very best estimate of how we can optimally get a really rigorous scientific answer. That includes the eligibility criteria. We can't deviate. Once that's approved, we can't even deviate by one day. So if I have an eligibility criteria for someone 70 and older, and you're 69 and 364 days, you'll have to wait till tomorrow. But I can still take you in. But if you've missed the cut, we can't. And if we do that, our IRB will penalize us to a point that I don't even want to discuss it with you. You can actually be not allowed to do research anymore if it's that bad. Or you can get a reprimand, but any reprimand by our IRB or any IRB is not a pleasant experience. So we go through this whole thing. Now we have to find someone. We found someone. They're really eligible. Now I've got to make sure you're still interested. Oh, I have to come and have something done 14 times in the next 6 months. But what about that trip I had planned to Paris? And my daughter's having a baby, and my cat's having kittens. All of a sudden, these things that we need you there for seem a little bit overwhelming. So we need to try to interest you and retain your interest. Then we actually go through the process of enrolling you in the study, and it may be in that process that we discover your blood pressure's too high. Or we discover some other problem. You have diabetes. And those are disqualifiers for being in the study. And we finally find that one person, that needle in the haystack, and we enroll that person. Just think how much time that took. And oh, by the way, I need to get 389 people just like that person from this community. And I need diversity. I don't want just all you nice white guys stepping up to the plate. Because that's what happens. If I were to say to you, quick, I need a volunteer, hurry, quick, and not even tell you why, I will guarantee the first hand up will be some white guy. It's always the way that I've done this 100 times in classrooms, in teaching scenes around the world. It's always the first person with a hand up. The problem is if we do all of our studies on the first guy who raises his hand, the findings will only be good for men just like him. We won't know if the study results can be generalized to women. The Framingham study in Massachusetts, a wonderful example. Only men in the study. And they discovered that aspirin really saved lives. And so the women said, so should I take an aspirin a day? And they said, we don't know. There were no women in the study. So we need to have diversity, age, ethnic groups, racial groups, economic groups. Economic groups are the big one. The biggest diversity is not among racial groups and it's not among genders. It's among socioeconomic groups. Consistently, it's among socioeconomic groups. So we try to find the greatest diversity possible. So you can imagine how long this takes. Well, there are multiple problems, one of which is the public is really, really poorly informed. And the other is that there's a scientific infrastructure dysfunction. Our scientific infrastructure is really, really inadequate. So let's talk about the public being poorly informed first. Simple solution, just go out and talk to the public and tell them they should get involved in research. Unfortunately, it's really more complicated than that. We find there are 4 major areas that become barriers in the community, and let's look at each of those separately. The first is lack of awareness of the personal benefits. Why should I get involved in a research study? What's in it for me? And we say to you, well, there really aren't supposed to be any direct benefits to you. There really aren't, because that would be coercive. If there were major benefits to you, if I could give you something that cost you a fortune on the outside of a research study, that would be coercive. So we can't really have any direct benefits. You'll feel good, maybe, because you're helping to develop new discoveries. Your involvement might even benefit a loved one. Diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, many family diseases. It's certainly conceivable that if you took part in a research study, you could actually benefit a loved one a generation or two later, or maybe even yourself. But we don't know that going in. That's why we're doing the research, because we don't know if it will work or not. Maybe, just maybe, it's a big maybe, you will have a benefit. It is possible. It has happened. We've had major scientific breakthroughs. And the people who took part in the study, who were randomized to the experimental arm, the intervention group, actually benefited. Not everybody, but enough benefited that the scientific community said, this is worth doing. And the people in the control arm, because they were already in the study, were allowed to have access then to that intervention because they'd helped do the science. It still now has to go through years and years of approval through the Food and Drug Administration. So that is a possible benefit, but we never want to tell you that's going to happen because we don't know. It's a false promise, and we don't want to make a false promise to you. Okay, so here we go. So here's the question. Why not give us a big incentive? Wouldn't that make my job easier? I help the scientists recruit for studies, and I do my own research studies. Wouldn't that make this easier? The problem is, if we make the incentive so big, you might do something that you would not otherwise think was the wise thing to do. And this problem gets even greater because remember a few minutes ago I said we really need to reach out to the diverse socioeconomic community. And so what may seem like a pittance to a very wealthy person could be the difference between having or not having basketball shoes for a woman's son, having or not having food on the table. So we have to be very careful. Ethically, this is an ethical dilemma. Ethically, we cannot make the reward for taking part in a study so positive, so exciting, that you would do something you wouldn't normally do. You wouldn't be willing to volunteer to do. Therefore, we give you these very small thank yous. Cookies on the table. We might give you movie tickets, something very, very, very modest, because we don't ever want you to do something you wouldn't do. Another barrier, lack of community support. No one encourages me to enroll in a study. Not a single person, not my pastor, not my spouse, not my kids, not even my doctor. The doctor says, well, you know, I'm actually going to lose you as my patient, and we have a good relationship. The doctor also does not get very nice treatment often from the researchers, because we get so involved in research, we forget. We don't have that infrastructure that lets us keep calling back that patient's physician, so that when the patient goes to see the primary care doctor who referred her in the first place, the doctor knows what's going on. We have to be better at that, and we keep trying, but this is an infrastructure expensive problem. So it's a challenge. Rarely does anybody have someone say, I got involved in research, you should try it too. Just explore it, see what's out there for you. And that would really be winning. So the more people we can involve, the better. Another problem that comes up, and you heard this a lot in our last session, was mistrust of the research process, as well as misunderstandings of many research terms. So there are historical precedents that certainly cause people to distrust researchers. There's no question. Does it happen today? Much less so. But can it still happen today? Yes. It can always happen. You can always have a renegade researcher or a renegade assistant who just bends the rules a little bit. It can still happen. But if it happens, the penalties are huge. And so scientists are very careful to not let that happen. But then we have these complicated terms like blind, double-blind studies. Why do I have to be blind? And why can't my doctor even know what drug I'm taking? Surely my doctor should know. Randomized controlled trials. What in heaven's name is that? Crossover models. What is that? Stratification and placebos. Everyone's afraid of the placebo. I work my entire life in the area of clinical trials. I was visiting my parents last winter. My mother's friend was thinking about going into a research study. And my mother, who's a nurse, said, but you might get the placebo. I said, how can you not understand placebo, Mom? You're a nurse. You're educated. You've got me for a daughter. She still really didn't understand the placebo is only given when we have nothing useful to give to you. Nothing. If we give you a drug that's already failed, you're just going to have side effects, but you won't have any benefit because we know it's already failed. So the placebo is there when we really don't have a better option for you. And then the lack of familiarity with the research process. How many of you took science for 4 or 5 or 8 years? Probably only a few of you. You all like science or you wouldn't be here. It's an interesting thing for you or you wouldn't be here. But really, if I said to you, quick, step up here and sign up for this study, there's a genuine fear of the unknown. You just don't know what all is involved. Losing control. No one has ever taken part that I know in a research study. I have no idea what will happen. Can I get out of a research study if I want to? People don't know. And then we take you through the informed consent process. This is supposed to tell you everything you need to know about this study. And the legal defense department writes this because they want you to know everything that could possibly go wrong. And they'll begrudgingly allow us to tell you some of the things that could go right. But this is to protect you. But it is legalistic so that you understand this is a very serious document. We do not want you to engage in a research study unless you fully understand what we're talking about. It's a trustworthy process, and there's plenty of oversight. But it is still a legal-sounding document, which can really frighten people. Now, And I'm getting near the end of this presentation, so you can be thinking of some questions. I'd like to talk to you briefly about the scientific infrastructure problems that we have, because they are almost insurmountable for us. If you have an illness, let's imagine there's high blood pressure in your family, and you think, well, let me get enrolled in a study. That lady last night, she really inspired me. I'm going to go look for a high blood pressure study for people who have a family history of high blood pressure. There is no central listing. You can't just go to one website and find everything you want. Our government can find every single submarine, but that's because they're always there. And they can tell you even which direction it's facing. But we can't tell you every single research study because they come and they go. We have a study for a year, we have a study for 3 years, and it's finished. So there's no central repository. We try. The university tries, the government tries, but it's this very moving target. And so it's hard to have the central listing. We have incredibly strict eligibility requirements, as we just discussed. Language can be very, very confusing. If you speak English, it still can be confusing. But if English is your second language, it's even more confusing. One of the groups that I work with is the deaf and hard of hearing community. They work in sign language. Everything that I do has to be translated into American Sign Language so that I'm sure they're understanding. It's imperative. We have a study with the Hispanic community. Same thing. Everything is translated into Spanish so that if someone says, well, Spanish is really my preferred language, we have a way to make that possible. We also have no navigators. If you're sick, there's usually someone in your doctor's office who will help you figure out the pathway to go to next. The nurse might set up the next two or three visits with the screening services, blood services when you need a blood draw. That doesn't happen as much with clinical trials. We don't have a person called a clinical trials navigator. We're actually trying that at UCSD right now, and we've proven that it works. But when we first started, it took over 900 touches. So I touch you with information to produce one person to a research study. Can you imagine how slow that process is? And then, of course, we have the problems with our insurers. They don't want you to spend more money, and our physicians are already overworked. So to ask them to do more when they're already working with less is a real hardship for them. Now, for children, we just were talking about adults, but for children, it's a very different story. If you're a child and you have a severe illness, complicated illness, a rare illness, a life-threatening illness, any of those illnesses, your pediatrician will send that child to a children's hospital or a university medical center that specializes in children with that disease or that proximity of diseases. There's interinstitutional collaboration because children with these diseases are so rare that a doctor at Rady Children's Hospital will be calling the LA Children's Hospitals and the Washington, D.C. Children's Hospitals to try to find a placement for this child to get the right care. We don't have that in the adult world. We don't operate with an infrastructure that everybody with cancer is going to go to a cancer center or a university. It's a different experience for adults than children have. And then you have the fact that people who get chronic life-threatening diseases tend to be older. And the first thing they're going to say is, well, why take part in a research study? I'll just do the standard of care. I know what I'm going to get into. My doctor knows what I'm going to get into. It's all familiar to all of us. I'll just do that. And if I get three or four more good years, I'll be 90 years old. I think I've lived a pretty good life. I've outlived all my friends. In children's, winning 3 or 4 years of life isn't adequate, as my colleague will tell you. She's the fighter for the children. She's not going to let a child die if she can help it. But if a child is going to die because we don't have the right care, she's going to find a study for that child so we can learn and help other children so that they don't die needlessly if we can find an answer for them. So in children's, we have these bulldog champions. You know, they just get on the issue, they won't let go of it until they've got a better solution. if what we have isn't enough, they're going to find a better solution. And so it's a little bit of a different environment. The result has been that in children's cancers, the survival rate is phenomenal. From cancer, for example. When I was growing up, I had three or four friends. I think I must have been in some kind of a cluster. We just had three or four friends that had leukemia. They all died within months of the discovery of their leukemias. That doesn't happen today. It's the exception that that happens. So we're doing something really well for kids. So for the adults, and this is my very last slide, it's really like looking for a needle in a haystack. For us to do the best possible science, we need everybody in the community understanding what's involved in creating that science and at least being open to considering it. A physician will say to me, if a patient comes in and asks me, are there any clinical trials for me? Or says, I'm open to an exploration of clinical trials, so if you know of any, please tell me. I will spend time with that patient. But if that patient says nothing, I'm not about to go out and spend 2 or 3 hours researching studies on the internet, making phone calls, checking eligibility criteria, only to say, I found the perfect study for you. And he says, I'm not interested in the study. I want the standard of care. So we need to have the community understanding more about why research is the answer that we're all waiting for. Only through research will we know that a drug truly works. We can't just guess, because when you guess, you get it wrong as often as you're going to get it right. So we've made more progress in controlling children's cancers. We could do the same for adults. And tonight, we're here to talk about how we help adults get the same benefits that we've given for children. And so now it's time for us to talk.
Great. So we'll go ahead and start with the question and answer segment. And I think that there are already some people lined up for that. So go right ahead.
These questions are based on our homework assignment, which some of us have done more carefully than others. Let me say first off that I agree with your general conclusion. I have participated in clinical studies, and they're very interesting. But let me ask two questions. One comes from this blurb, which you can all read. And that is, it says here that the National Institutes of Health has mandated that research involving human subjects must be conducted with samples that are representative. And we talked a little about that. My first question is, what happens if a study is done that isn't representative? Let me ask the second one, and then I'll sit down, because the second one is based on Henrietta Lacks's book, which you refer to. And that is that Henrietta Lacks's family's situation and the John Moore case, which is famous in California at least, both suggest that people who enter research studies may not be treated justly or fairly when interesting things and commercial things are found from the research. I think that unfortunately remains a problem in the United States, and I wonder how it's being addressed.
Thank you for your question. There's really multiple answers to it. First of all, let me do the first one, and then I probably have forgotten the second one by that time. The first one is, every scientist who's funded to do research, at the end of their year, they must complete an enrollment form for the National Cancer Institute and for their institutional review board. And on that, you say, what is the ethnic group of all of your participants, and what is the gender? So those are the two big questions. Is this person Hispanic American? Is this person African American, Native American, Pacific Islander, Asian American? You go through every single one of those items and you say how many participants you recruited. If you do not have a diverse sample, and by diverse they're saying, what is your community looking like today? So if you have 8% of your community is Asian American, you're expected to have at least 8% of Asian Americans enrolled in your study. and that's how we're judged. If you do not meet the criteria, the first year there's going to be a question, why not? What happened? And they'll coach you. They'll get somebody like me who spends a lot of time in the community who knows how to do better recruitment. Good example, we had the Shiley Eye Center was looking for African Americans who had normal eyes. They had many African Americans who had glaucoma at their institute because they care for patients with that disease. What they didn't have were people with normal eyes, and they could not find someone. Well, for me, that was a very easy. Let's just go to some of the ARP groups in downtown San Diego and find some folks who are interested. Let's go to some of the black churches. So part of it is knowing how to do it and doing it in a way that makes sense to the community, just the way we're talking tonight. So that's the first thing. If you fail to recruit a representative study, the government can actually close you down. They can say, this is not acceptable, and shut your whole research down. They can also close your research down if you're not recruiting fast enough, because you're burning money. If you have a technician there waiting for someone to come in to spin bloods, you're wasting money. So there are multiple ways that you can be reviewed and evaluated and determined if you're functioning adequately in your laboratory or not. Now, the next question you raise is a really interesting one, and it really has to do with science getting ahead of ethics. We sometimes make discoveries that we never even imagined would be possible. And so we don't have the ethical guidelines in place ahead of time. And that's what people like Michael Kalikman spends his whole professional life looking at. There's another group that I think you would enjoy looking at some of their publications called the Hastings Institute in Hastings, New York. And it's a huge ethics study center. That's all they do is look at the ethical issues of what's happening. And so the problem for us, it's like when we were able to clone a new sheep from a cell. Who would have thought that was possible? It was just inconceivable, even for the ethicist at the time. So we weren't prepared. There were things happening that we had no way of even imagining what to do. This is full-time employment, because now the ethicists are saying, well, how do we fix that? How do we go back and make that a different outcome? And what is the guiding principles? What are the guiding principles we should follow? How do we know how to proceed? And unfortunately, unless we have community involvement, we don't know what you want, because it's really your futures that we're talking about. So an IRB, an Institutional Review Board, has lay people on their study sections. So if you're interested in becoming more informed about clinical research, it's very easy to join an IRB. There are many of them around town, and they're always short of volunteers. This is, by the way, a volunteer thing. You don't get paid for this. The faculty all volunteer, and they're in there into the wee hours of the morning volunteering their time, because we care about this so much, and we want the science to be as good as possible. But the Henrietta Lack story there was no way you could have guessed that her cells would have been the one cells that lived. They had tried that so many times before, and it always failed. So no one really, really expected those cells to live, and what would they do if they lived? And how, they didn't even know how they would use them. The researcher just giving them away, carrying them in his pockets and just giving them away, trying to figure out, what do we do with this? So now here's the conundrum. One could say, that wasn't very well done. But on the other hand, think of the scientific progress we bumbled our way into discovering, because at least the people who were using the cells were ethical. They weren't being given to people trying to do negative things. They were all given to scientists. But you still raise questions. When there's an economic gain, who gets it? And that's a real question for the ethicists to handle, but also for the community to handle. I think your voices need to be heard. My voice, when I'm a community member, I'm not sitting on the stage, I have opinions. I hope you'll have opinions, and let them be known, because that's how we're going to figure out how to go forward. not by being afraid and worrying, but by really learning the issues as you're doing, talking with others, and sharing what your views are.
All right, thank you. Next question.
The new health care, which President Obama will have the honor of having called them Obamacare, and it's a good idea, also gives us an informatics opening. You spoke mostly about informatics problems. They're easy to solve than human problems. What has been done in the use of the proposed informatics to be able to find the volunteers for you? Remember, we can anonymize all of this. And then there's a secondary question, which comes from unintended consequences, which always get one. If you scientifically figure out how to treat patients, you then say, this is what you're going to get paid for. Well, a lot of medical discoveries and scientific discoveries are serendipity. Therefore, somebody makes a mistake and it works. How do you now put enough noise in the system, believe it or not, to make progress? Because you can keep things at a very well-controlled level, but the way you make changes is absolutely screwing things up sometimes.
Lots of questions there. So let's see if I can remember all of them. The first one is on the informatics. There's a bill that was passed called HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability Act, and that protects your privacy. If we do not follow that rule, it's equally as bad as not following IRB's rules. So while you can anonymize the data, you're absolutely right. So we have in California, for example, this wonderful database called the California Cancer Registry. Protect it with all your might, because that is the largest population-based cancer registry in the entire world. It is a phenomenal gift we have given to our state to fund this every year. You can look at that data anonymized, just as you're saying, and we can do that for every other disease. The problem is it's extraordinarily expensive to run. So you don't do it for just any old disease. You pick the worst of the diseases, cancer being the worst for many people. So then you say, well, what about the hospitals? They have lots of data. But our IRB is so rigid, we have to be very careful. We cannot take your data without your permission. So if you come to a hospital, if you go to Children's Hospital, for example, because I actually helped them to do this, every child that comes into the system, the parent signs a consent form that says, I am willing to have you notify me of studies in which my child, my children, or my family might be eligible to participate. And the family can check it off. Yes, call me for anything. No, don't call me. Call my doctor, and the doctor can decide, or I don't ever want to hear from you again. So we have the capacity to do that. But again, it's very expensive to manage, because if you make an error and you call someone who said, I absolutely never want to hear about it, you have a lawsuit. If someone breaks into that system, you have a lawsuit. So were someone to break into our cancer patient database and identify who has been there as a patient, not only will they know who has been there for cancer, but they'll also know every woman who went there for a routine mammogram, routine pharmacy, doesn't discern. But if the hacker is really clever, the hacker could actually figure out who has cancer. So it's this catch-22 that we live in. We have so much capacity. It's the same as the ethical issue. The capacity is phenomenal, but we have to proceed slowly and make sure we're doing it right the first time, whenever possible. We won't always do that, but whenever possible, to do it right the first time. And so the California Tumor Registry, it used to be called, now the California Cancer Registry, is a wonderful example of getting it right the first time. Now, you had other questions, and I have forgotten the second one.
That once you make a standard of care by doing your statistics, then you cut down the alternate methods of treatment. And sometimes someone's slightly screwball alternate method of treatment that one would think made no sense will actually work, or they picked up on something early. And those pieces of data are valuable. But and it's the theory of servos. If you get evolution, you've got to make mistakes. You can keep something perfectly stable, but then you don't make the mistakes that cause progress.
One of the exciting things for me working in a cancer center is it's multidisciplinary. We have the caregivers, we have the basic science researchers, the clinical researchers, the outreach people researchers, kind of research that I do, and we all work together. So when you discover an observation, she could be at Children's Hospital and say, I've got an idea. This doesn't seem to be working right with this child. And I've seen it before, I think. I want to explore it. She then calls another clinician who's an expert researcher in that area, and they start working together on it. The flip side that you don't want is people doing whatever recipe they think works today. We have a lot of evidence. We know if you've had a heart attack, we know the drugs you should be given to leave that hospital. We know the tests that should be done. We have a really good formula for the optimal patient outcome. You want that to be delivered all the time, but you also want her to have the option of changing the regimen if the first one doesn't work. And that's what this really is all about, trying to find the most evidence so that whatever you come in with, you're going to get treatment based on sound research discovery, not whatever that physician had handy that day or the nurse practitioner had handy. It's going to be based on sound scientific discovery, but always with the flexibility, as long as you document it in the chart, why you chose to change the regimen. So I think we'll get there.
Great, thank you. Next question, please.
I have five questions. Is that okay?
Can you give them one at a time to me, please? This is an Alzheimer's test.
So my first question is, how difficult is it to make a network of navigators and make sure that insurance companies would pay for these visits?
It's really hard. One of the things we're doing right now is to document the amount of work that's required. That example I gave you before of how many people you had to touch to get that one person into the study. We've been able to justify that because this little group is looking specifically at the minority communities because they are so much harder to recruit to a research study. So it's a very expensive process. However, the more we do it, the better we get at it. So our numbers are now much better, in part because the community trusts this person better. This person also comes with a whole three-ring binder full of studies. And let's say this gentleman calls and says he's interested. We meet with him, and the study that interested him, he's actually not eligible for. But we've already clarified that he's actually interested in being in research, and we say, you know, we've got a high blood pressure study that doesn't require high blood pressure. Maybe you're eligible for that. Oh, you have high blood pressure? Okay, let's go to number three. So we have the concept already developed and tested of how to do it. There's no question it will work. Now the trick is to find the funding mechanisms for it. And unfortunately, when you're writing a research grant, you may have a cap on that research grant. Well, you're going to get better scores if you put more science in than if you put more recruitment in. And no one thinks about, well, if you don't recruit, you won't get the study finished in the timely manner. So invariably, the recruitment gets short shrift in the budget. So we're trying to address those issues, again, with evidence that says it works.
Okay. Second question is related to breaking down the walls at the insurance companies. The insurance companies, why don't they provide these navigators or champions? And second part of that question is, if we're all paying with our jobs to have these insurance companies manage this healthcare process and they're not paying for this, why not?
We passed a bill a couple of years ago that mandated that if there was a clinical trial and it was outside of your healthcare system, the law required that you would be allowed to go to the other system. So we have it in place. We need you, the public, me, the public, to be informed and demand our legal rights. It is by law that you can move among healthcare systems.
I think we'll do one more question and then we'll move on with the program.
Give me an easy one. By the way, Howard Wayne, your own representative, was the guy who helped champion that bill. So people in town were talking to him and got him excited about that bill, and he ran with it.
How are you addressing the physician barriers?
Physician barriers are challenging. They're really challenging because what happens right now is if a physician wants to refer a patient to a study, the physician spends a lot of time finding the study, making the referral. All of it is uncompensated time. We need to fix that. That's the first thing that needs to be fixed. Because if we can get more results, more solid scientific discovery, we should have a healthier nation. So the first thing is to reward the physician, compensate the physician for making the referral. We have to get better as a research institute, and all of the institutes in the country have to get better at saying thank you for the referral and sending the patient back, telling the doctor what's happening with their patient. So there are definite things that we can do that will make a difference. Absolutely, not a question about it. But it's going to take some time. And I think, as you call it, Obamacare, that could really hold some magical opportunities for us.
I know the most recent RAND study definitely clarified there's a separate community issue and a physician issue as far as the barriers. And I don't know if you're familiar with that study that came out earlier this year.
Summarize it for everybody.
So there's the physician barriers, which would be, you know, like she was talking about, as far as the physicians don't necessarily want to lose the patient because they got the patient and they sort of want to make the money off of getting the drugs to that patient. And if you go to refer them in, then they lose that patient and then they're not taken care of. There's also that there's a, if you're a clinician, you know, you're doing one thing as far as a doctor and your business is concerned, and a physician scientist is sort of another thing. So there's a barrier between, we have physician scientists like at UCSD, but it's getting these clinicians who are more clinicians who aren't really physician scientists and bridging their gap to help them be able to mandate the ability to run and like a physician scientist and get their patients in and still possibly be able to manage their patient who wants to be with their physician. Right. And then separately would be the community issue where it's reaching out to more the minorities.
The ideal would be wherever possible, you allow the community physician to implement the trial with the patient. And so if you have a fairly simple trial, that's easy to do. But if the trial gets complex and that patient has to be there every Tuesday for that blood draw all the time that she's getting this drug, it's very hard for a community physician to have the infrastructure to do that. And then the physician gets dinged because he's not doing a good job. So it's a bit of a catch-22. Ideally, you'd love to do it that way. The best studies, my favorite studies, are ones where the patient stays with the doctor and then we also do something as well. So we ask a supplemental question. And I get those kind of studies to do because that's what I'm interested in. But the clinician who's worrying about drug study, the patients have to go where the fancy equipment is to do the analysis and where the infrastructure is to allow enough time to be spent on every single patient that we don't miss anything. Because if you miss something and there's no excuse for it, you're in trouble. You're really in trouble.
I wanted to touch upon the clinician barrier issue a bit and ask you, Georgia. I know you talked a bit about patient mistrust and being a bit distrustful of scientists. And I know that certainly for less life-threatening diseases in children, certainly kids with cancers, et cetera, it's rather easy to encourage parents to enroll their kids in these studies. But I do know that I'll use eczema as an example. There have been clinical trials at Children's Hospital. And one of the issues that comes up frequently for parents is really wondering if their kids are being experimented on. And I find that challenging often to really talk with a family about that and be reassuring to that particular family. Do you have any sort of suggestions or ideas as to some of the better ways to do that?
I think it's just the time. The time that we spend tonight is about how much time it takes a clinician to explain a research study to a patient. So think of the poor physician trying to teach every single patient this much. They cannot do it. So it really comes back to us as a community to learn what we need to know and then help each other to get that knowledge. Because most physicians, I can't think of a single physician, and I'm sure you can't either, who has time to spend 2 hours per patient discussing clinical trials, particularly if that patient's not interested. So it's a real challenge to get this done. But the breakthrough could be if the community is better informed. So when you walk into your doctor's office and you say, I've got this problem, let's talk about clinical trials. However, I will tell you how hard that is. I have a number of times where I'll look on the internet for something for someone and I can't find it. I cannot find a trial, no matter how hard I try. And I'm pretty good at looking for trials, but I can't find one. Even for myself, if I wanted to look for myself, I've had a hard time finding trials for normal women, right? Abnormal women, depending on how you look at me. But it's really hard to find those trials, so it takes some real perseverance. Unfortunately, it takes some serious computer skills, some internet searching skills also, to find those trials. And then if you don't have those skills and you say to your doctor, what do you have for me? The doctor doesn't have that much more time either. So it's a real challenge. We really need the patient navigator. We really need a clinical trials navigator to help people figure out their way through this conundrum. It just keeps going on and on. It's a maze.
Thank you. Next question.
How often does this situation occur, and what do you do about it? If you have a funded study and you don't have enough people, do you extend the search, delaying the project by months or years, or do you cancel the project or other alternatives?
Usually the project is canceled, and it's canceled for in addition to those reasons. First, you run out of money. So if you hire a technician 50% time on this study and 50% on another study, and you don't get enough patients, the tech still gets paid. So the money runs out pretty quickly. The second thing that happens, though, and this happens at a cancer center, for example, where I work, where we'll say, gosh, we have 24 studies open, and not one of them has accrued a patient in the past year. We're going to declare them all closed. Because when the National Cancer Institute does our periodic review, we lose points if we have trials open that have not accrued a patient. Now, pediatrics is different. Cancer is so rare in children. I mean, it seems like it's a lot, but it's really a rare disease when you think of how many children are not at Children's Hospital getting care for their cancer. So there, you might have 20 studies open, and you may only accrue one child to a study a year. But Children's Hospitals are bringing that data all together. So they have a collaboration or a consortium of children's hospitals. So when you have a very rare study, that's one way of doing it. You all work together, and you have one central hospital that receives the data, and then they analyze it that way. So when you have a rare disease, that's the best way to study. You get many people around the country, all good scientists, all who understand they have to follow these very rigorous protocols, and you collect the data that way. But it's very sad when you know you have patients who are suffering and you cannot recruit a patient to it, or they don't fit the eligibility requirements exactly.
Is there a very large percentage of the studies that do get canceled because of that for the adult studies?
Yes. Yeah.
More than half?
I wouldn't say more than half, but it's not unusual to just look at 20 studies that have been on the books for 2 years and they don't have any, not a single patient in them yet. And we're still looking. It's not that we're not looking. They just don't have a patient accrued. One of the black humor in science is if you say to yourself, if you want a disease to go away completely, start to study it. Because all of a sudden, nobody has it anymore. It's the best way to cure disease. It just goes away.
Next question.
I'd like to ask about health insurance and cost to patients of clinical trials. A family member was in a clinical trial this year for a new cancer drug, and the biggest hurdle to his participation was to show that he had adequate insurance coverage, not for the drug itself, but for the lab tests and what have you. He had high-end insurance, so he got in. So far, his out-of-pocket costs are about $4,000. So if someone asked him, how did you like being on a clinical trial, he would talk about the expense of it. How do you get around that?
Ideally, you set up a study so that there is no expense to the patient. So you have to ask how much of this would have been out of pocket anyway. The clinical trial will cover the cost of whatever is not covered by your insurance company. That's generally how they're set up. So if you would normally have a spinal tap for your brain cancer, and that's part of the normal therapy, it would be covered by your health insurance. Now, you'll have copays on that. So if your copay is 20% and you have a serious cancer, you could very easily rack up $4,000 in a matter of weeks of studies. But the part that's covered is from the study is the part that's extra above and beyond the cost of normal care. But normal care is extraordinarily expensive. I had a reporter called me about one of the bills that we were putting forward. It's actually about Obamacare. And she said, of course, this doesn't pertain to me, but I'm interested for the other people. And I said, why doesn't it pertain to you? Why is that not an issue for you? She said, well, I have health insurance. Okay. I said, let's think about this. You have health insurance, and you have a salary. So if we imagine that your health bills for the next year, when you're really in intensive therapy, were $100,000, do you have $20,000 in discretionary funds to pay for what your insurance company doesn't cover? The insurance company usually will cover 80%, and it's a copay. And some of us are lucky, we have a cap on the copay, but not everybody has good insurance like that. And all of a sudden, she said, this is about my issue, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it's really your issue because the copays are so high that even if you have insurance, you can still go bankrupt.
Next question.
Dr. Sadler, thank you for being here tonight. Can you clarify the misconception regarding the placebo? And let's take for an example, let's say you have some malady and there is a standard of care, which is a certain drug, and it works fairly well. Is the misconception that if you're going into this clinical study for a new drug, you're either going to get the new drug or a sugar pill, so you're going to get no care or the experimental care? Is that the misconception, and the truth is that, no, you're either going to get the new drug or the standard of care? Is that correct?
This is my favorite question. Thank you for asking it, because this is the one that scares people the most. Let's imagine you have a life-threatening disease, and you go into a research study, and they have a randomized controlled trial. You will be assigned to either the new therapy or the standard of care. Always. Except, what if you've had your breast cancer for 12 years and you've tried every therapy and it got you through the next recurrence? You tried the next one and you tried the next one, and all of a sudden you've now run out of drugs. Now, what do? We have an exciting new drug. And you're eligible for it because you've failed prior drugs. What do we do? Do we say, here, take this drug because it won't work? We already tested it on you, and we know it won't work, and it will have side effects. But at least I'm giving you something. You wouldn't want that, because then I'm reducing the quality of your life. We're doing harm at that point. We're taking away the quality of the years you have left, because we know that drug will cause side effects, and it will not do you any good. You've already failed that drug, or that drug, more correctly, has failed you. So, do we then say, okay, well, we're going to randomly assign you. This group will have the new drug, and this group gets nothing, right? So I say to the group, here, you're getting the drug, and this group's not. And now, every time I see you, I say, how you doing? And your family says, you don't look good today. And you look in the mirror and you think, man, I wish I'd gotten the experimental drug. I'm not getting anything. There's no hope because I failed everything. Everything's failed me, and I don't have a chance. Well, there's something called the immune system in our bodies, and that responds to different things. And we don't know how to make it happier. But we do suspect that if you have hope, you might at least feel better. So the placebo is there to equalize the playing field. So nobody knows what they got. It all looks the same. You all got little blue pills to take 3 times a day. And nobody knows if it's the placebo or if it's the new exciting drug. Now what happens is when I see you and I'm the doctor, or actually she's the doctor, I'm the PhD, and she looks at you and she says, hey, you look great, how you feeling? And neither of them know what she has, drug-wise. Neither of them know. And it's only after the study's finished and they've gotten this medication for whatever the prescribed period is. Let's say it's a 4 cycle for 4 months. At the end of that, they measure tumor. They measure side effects in everybody in the study. And only then do they then say, okay, let's break the code. Number 482 GFQ was experimental. Number 743 PQ was control. And only then do they break the data into 2 groups and discover that, in fact, the new drug did or didn't make any difference. Now, why is that important? So we had a drug that was great at pain relieving. People who had pain that they could not get rid of, no matter what they did, nothing would relieve it. And so they had a randomized controlled trial with this exciting new drug that they really believed was going to make a difference. And placebo and not, because they were going to allow you to keep taking your existing pain meds. So we weren't taking anything away. So here's another example of the placebo. Nothing is removed. You keep taking anything you want to take for your pain. That's prescribed, obviously. And then we'll give you this additional drug because we think the additional drug supplemented by your pain meds will make the pain better. The first person that got the drug had been in pain for 12 years. Miserable. Wanted to shoot his foot off. His foot hurt so badly, right? Immediate relief of that pain. Instantaneous. Within days, he was all better. It wasn't until they broke the code that they found he got the sugar pill. So you can see we have to do this kind of science. Because if we just went on anecdote, he was so happy. Maybe something else happened in his life. I don't know. I mean, you know, we hear people, they have a bad job and they have these headaches that don't go away. Stop the job and the headache goes away. So things happen in our lives that can change, and maybe this person had something change in his life, or that whatever nerve was being pinched just stopped being pinched all of a sudden. Who knows? But he had relief from the sugar pill. And it didn't go away when he knew he didn't have it. He just was better. So we have to have this rigorous science. Otherwise, we'll make the wrong conclusions.
Thank you. If you will, one more quick question. Can you also clarify the ethical issue regarding compensating a participant in the study, and that it's very interesting that you're talking about compensating the doctors for referring the patients. Well, that's easy, but not compensating the patients for being in the study. And there's many jobs that people don't want to do where they have to show up 3 or 4 times a week to do something maybe uncomfortable or painful, and yet it's not a moral issue. I wonder if the issue is, as long as it doesn't compromise the scientific validity of the patient participating 4 times a week, why is it a problem that they're being paid to do something that they wouldn't normally do?
It's not that we can't pay. It's that we cannot give you so much that you would do something you wouldn't normally do. And I can tell you, I personally had a study turned down because I wanted to compensate people $100 to come 2 weeks in a row on a Saturday morning to fill out about 2 hours worth of questionnaires. And I was told that was coercive by the folks in Washington. So these are people that are, you know, rigorous ethicists. They guard the science. And to them, $25 an hour was too much. Never mind that the person had to get up on Saturday morning, get dressed, drive, find a child care person maybe, or a mother care person. It didn't matter. It was just too much. So the logic is, we should never give you enough incentive that it would get you to do something that you wouldn't normally do. And we're not looking here at the rank and file of the socioeconomic status. You have to look at the person who has the least income, because you don't give people remuneration based on their income. Everybody gets the same thing. It's an equal playing field. So while I might have to give you $500 to make it worth your time to be in a sleep study for 2 nights, to somebody else, that's a cruise that they'd never have. That's a chance to take their wife on a honeymoon. That's a chance maybe to put the kids through a special program, the summer baseball camp or something. So we just cannot make that reward, that thank you, so much that someone would do something they wouldn't do. And the best examples, and it's not science, it's different. It's kidney harvesting. Kidney harvesting in third world countries, where a woman will give a kidney for $250 because that's a lot of money to her. It's unethical, but it's done. And it's being stopped. But you've got to find that trafficking. And so it's an extreme example, but it's an example of why it's so important to always watch our ethics when there's someone who could be taken advantage of.
Georgia, could you elaborate on how much is too much? How is that typically determined?
It's usually more a case of how much does a person earn. And so $25 an hour was viewed as too much per hour. And it was my mistake. What I should have said is, we're compensating this person for driving to the study, getting dressed up, having to wait for half an hour, so actually she'll really be there for 3 hours or 4 hours, and then it would have been fine. You know, I was a little more naive in those days than I am now. I'm pretty savvy in this stuff. But never coercive. I mean, you cannot be an unethical person. But I just was silly. I just didn't understand how the rules worked in those days. But it was a good example to say, this is really important, and it's taken really seriously by every scientist.
Great, thanks. Next question.
Hi, I'd like to thank you for your time and your energy, not just tonight, but collectively, first off. But I have a question and sort of a comment, and I teach high school students, so you'll have to forgive me. Maybe this just comes from what I deal with and think about all day. But in terms of informing the public and generating interest and kind of localizing the information of studies and trials that are available, have there been thoughts or ideas about social media as we move towards that technologically? Has there been thoughts towards using those tools?
Great question. And yes, yes, yes. However, think about who uses those tools. The young people who don't get sick very often right now. the next couple of generations will be in much better shape. But right now, the person who is likely to have cancer, someone in their 60s, 70s, 80s, they're technologically challenged more often than not. So where do we go? We go to their kids. So yes, absolutely. I work with the deaf community a lot in my research, and they're very technologically competent because that's their connection with the world. So there we use viral marketing, spiral marketing, however you want to call it, and we'll say, you know, like the chain letters, send this to 10 friends. That happens on the internet and makes me crazy because I don't have time for that. But it's a perfect example of the viral marketing you're talking about. Send this to 10 people. So we have a study right now. We're trying a new approach. We have a video in sign language about smoking cessation for the deaf community. Deaf community is not a lot of smokers. They're, especially in California, we smoke at about 14%. We are the lowest smoking rate. We tie with Utah. So how do we find smokers? So we went online. And we're trying to do it that way. So it's a perfect example of yes, yes, yes. And that works for that community. We're getting people to refer to us. But when you're talking about diseases that affect people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, you have to go down to their children and their grandchildren. But you can still do that. And it's a great way. And also, Alka, where are you? She helped with the... Did she leave? There she is. She helped with the editorial. So there is print media... There's electronic media. Word of mouth is fantastic. You know, I hope you'll all go home. I challenge you, I dare you, all of you to go home and talk to 10 people about this in a way that they can talk to 10 more people. One of our studies was with African-American beauticians here in San Diego about breast cancer and diabetes. We trained the stylist. She trained her clients, and then she challenged her client to talk to 10 more women. It worked. So... marketing, and any way you can do it. Yes.
Thank you. I think we have time for one or two more questions. Two more questions.
Good. I only have one.
Okay. Perfect.
I know a woman. She lived back east. She was diagnosed with cancer of a variety which we at the time were not terribly good at curing and was told she had a very short time to live to go home and get her affairs in order. And she got herself referred to a clinical trial some years ago now. And lo and behold, it was using thalidomide to treat the variety of cancer. And I don't frankly remember what kind of cancer it was. It was very successful. She was told she had 6 months to get her affairs in order. We're 5 or 6 years on, and she's still with us. But the clinical trial ended. And thalidomide was, in fact, approved for treatment of this cancer in its beginning stages. But because she had been in a clinical trial for several years, she was told she was not eligible to get a prescription for the drug because she was no longer in the beginning stages of cancer and that she would have to go off of it and die. Where is the logic in this, and how do we overcome that as an ethical issue?
It doesn't make sense. I mean, to any of us in the room, it doesn't make any sense because you can always do off-label care. A physician can prescribe it off-label. Maybe her insurance company wouldn't cover it. That may be the rub. Maybe they wouldn't cover it. But a physician, if she's doing well on a drug and it's now approved by the FDA for this use, they can always do off-label. They can also do conscientious access to a drug. So that if the drug is not approved for this particular disease, but it seems to be working, there's reason to think it's working, or a person was in the study and now they can't get it, there are ways to do that. So maybe...
She is now going over the border into Canada to get her medication.
It's the healthcare system.
Yes. Thank you. Last question.
I argue with myself over this because I love science, and my aunt growing up worked at UCSD and was doing cancer research. But I also know there's a ton of money to be made from pharmaceuticals. And so when I listen to you talking about doing research and clinical trials, my question always is, who's making money off that at the end of the day? Are you separate than pharmaceutical companies? Are you funded by them? And quite, I mean, for me, like, that's always the question I want to know before I'd be interested in participating in a trial, because there has been bad history on that. And at the end of the day, are you looking out for me? Or are you looking out for the next product that you want to sell? And that as soon as it's, you know, we're looking at patents expiring, and now suddenly it's going to be available for everybody. So you at UCSD, or UCSD, and then I also hear, you know, do you guys only do clinical trials on drugs? Do you do clinical trials on vitamin therapy or lifestyle changes, things like that? So I'm kind of curious, like, I just hear drug trials, which always, at the end of the day, is about money. So that's kind of, if you could speak to that, I would feel like you had more credibility and I could trust what you were saying more.
It's a great closing question. Thank you for asking it. Because one of my dilemmas in preparing this talk tonight was, I don't do clinical trials research. I am not a clinician as my colleague is. I'm interested in behavioral research. I want to know, how do I get African-American women to get a mammogram every year, starting at age 40? I want to know, how do I get African-American women to go in to get diabetes screening? I want to know, does problem-solving therapy help a woman cope better when her husband has prostate cancer? We know that men do better in a significant relationship. So there are lots of people like me out there also. But we were talking really about clinical research and the HeLa cells, and so I really kept the focus there very, very narrow. But when you ask about who makes the money, the problem is, if we do a vitamin study, it's hard to get funding for it because nobody will make any money. If we do a dietary study, UCSD has been famous for its dietary studies. Who wants to pay for it? The federal government. These are hugely expensive studies. But if we don't do the studies, we won't know the answer. So you go to the federal government for that. And for the other studies that are a drug, sometimes the drug company will offer you funding to help recruit patients to test their drug. Now, it's easy for us to say, oh, look how greedy they are. But for every drug that works, there are so many that don't. And that's why we do these studies. Sometimes they fail in the petri dish. Sometimes they fail in an animal model. Sometimes they fail in the human model. But there are so many failures along the way. You know, cutting room floor, we drop these studies like nothing, because they didn't work the way we thought they would work, or they worked but they weren't robust enough. They just didn't get enough results. So the few drugs that do rise to the top, if they don't make money on those, they go out of business. So it's a love-hate relationship. We don't want people to make money on our suffering, but if they don't make money, why would they want to be in business? They might as well go out and make Kool-Aid or something else that can make money. So there are people that like making money. You know, I like doing research, and that's cool. And they like doing businesses that make a lot of money. But we need them as our partners. What we need to also do is just control how much money is made. There has to be agreed quota. You know, there has to be a way of controlling that. If we say to people, you can't make any money in the drug world, we're going to lose some of our best minds. It's that catch-22. We're mostly funded by the National Institutes of Health. That's where the bulk of our money comes from. I think I'm bad at these brag statistics, but we have some huge amount proportionally compared to other institutions. We're very, very successful in recruiting NIH funding. And you're about to say something. Do you want to add?
No, I'm agreeing with you that it's correct.
We get a lot of money from the federal government. But we also get money from the drug companies. We're actually less attractive to the drug companies because we're so expensive. So they would rather go with a less expensive system than ours. And unfortunately, my biggest worry is to save money. A lot of these drug company studies are going overseas because they're cheaper. So tell me, is that winning? I mean, that really scares me. You know, do I really want a study that was done overseas in a third world country that none of us had any role in?
I would imagine that brings up any number of interesting issues as well, right?
Yes.
In terms of institutional review boards, and are those abided by? And if not, who will complain about it?
Right.
So,
Great. Well, thank you. I think this ends the answer and question and answer portion of our session. And thank you all for your very thoughtful questions. Thank you, Dr. Sadler, for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you for moderating.
So before you leave, since we do just have just a moment, it is really fitting that we finish on this mistrust question, not because I want us to feel unhappy, but because this is an ethics program. We want to figure out where the challenges are and how they best be addressed. And Lyndia, before the program, we talked very briefly about your experience as a clinician. And I'm not sure if everybody, especially those in the room who carry the burden of the privilege of being white, may not know what it's like to be non-white and part of an underrepresented group. And I thought maybe you could just very briefly tell them what you've heard from your patients, and maybe very briefly Georgia can tell us a simple answer for those people about the challenges that they're facing. So
I think that's a great question, especially since one of the things we're really talking about and celebrating tonight is the Henrietta Lacks story. And one of the things Mike and I talked about earlier is I would say roughly 30% of my patient practice is comprised of underrepresented minority patients or families. And often, especially, I must say, with my African-American patients, one of the issues that comes up whenever we talk about potentially enrolling kids in trials, et cetera, is, and I sort of get this immediate response, well, why would I do that? I mean, don't you know they experiment on us? And it's interesting because this clearly has a historical context, but it continues to be interesting to me because it is something that is still rather fresh in the minds of many of our families. And I find that to be very challenging. And my sense is that I, as an African-American woman, many of these patients are somewhat comfortable sharing that with me. And so I want to be able to allay their fears, but certainly I'm very mindful of the fact that history is what it is. And it's incredibly well described. It is sort of passed on from generation to generation, many times by oral history. So it becomes a challenge. And I don't necessarily know that I always have a great way of making patients more comfortable when I'm presented with that. And I know, Georgia, you have a lot of experience in that particular community. So
I think there's nothing that substitutes for time, thoughtful conversation. That's really where it starts. Just what we're doing tonight is what I would do with a patient. We work with the African-American community and black churches and salons and barbershops. It's all about taking the time to explain why they're being disadvantaged by not being in a study. It's the flip. And it's how history, however terrible it was, is actually being magnified today because people are afraid to do what's now actually helpful to them. And so the oral history telling for the African-American community especially never comes with the other side of the story. And it scares people. It suggests that nothing has changed, and so much has changed. Just the fear with which I do everything right, because heaven forbid they would shut down my lab. And every scientist feels the same way. And there, any day, a review person can walk into your office and say, let me see, I think you have a subject number 842 enrolled in your XYZ study. Show me the consent document. And I have to find that. And believe me, I do. I can. Because I'm so scared that we won't be able to someday. So that's the scientist today. We have rules and regulations. It's very different doing science today than it was decades ago, when there was no training program for how to be a scientist. There were no rules and regulations. There was no review committee. There was nothing that prepared a scientist to be a scientist. The whole Tuskegee story is a tragedy, but it wasn't the science that was so bad. It was just badly informed. But the terrible part of it was, the ethical part, was when they knew they had a drug that treated the syphilis, and the men were not given that drug. So we've gotten much better with our science, but we're still not perfect. There will still be flaws, or there will be perceived flaws, because if we don't understand science, we can misunderstand science. If we don't have a chance to do what you're doing tonight, one-on-one, talk to the scientists, come talk to the clinicians, learn, get informed, if we don't accept that responsibility, then we run the risk of not knowing what to do and what's right and how to help our colleagues who may not have had the opportunities that you've had or to come here tonight. And I'll give you all my cards so you can all call me with your questions. It's a privilege that you've given yourself to come and learn. And now we need to share that with other people so that we get the word out, but especially with our diverse communities. San Diego is so rich. We are so blessed with the diversity of our community. It's such a wonderful fabric. But we have a responsibility to make sure that the messages, that all of the messages, not just about clinical trials, but all of the social health and well-being benefits that we have to offer are equally distributed through our community.
So I think I'd better help us conclude now. So I think the bottom line is what you've pointed out, I think, very well, is scientists are human, and I hope everyone appreciates the value of actually having conversations like this. So the scientists who might otherwise sometimes make mistakes can hear from the public and be kept on an appropriate track. We all have to be part of that conversation. This is very much a two-way street. I want to thank both Drs. Willis Jacobo and Dr. Sadler for their really insightful comments and help with tonight's program. I want to thank the audience for your questions. Certainly not everybody else had a chance to ask questions, but I think Dr. Sadler would be happy to talk to some of you if you have a few minutes afterwards. And I want to encourage everyone to, again, complete the evaluation forms to give us an idea of what to do for future programs. But one last thing, for those of you who would have some thoughts in your mind right now that you would like to get out there, we have a very strong connection with Voice of San Diego, where there's regularly material put from our programs on their website. And one of the things that we're doing after our programs is capturing comments from people in the audience after the program. So if you have a thought, a reaction to this evening's program, the back of the room, Dr. Tate Hurwitz is standing there, camera in hand, or no, I'm sorry, tape recorder in hand. I will have the camera in hand. And we would love to hear from you to get your thoughts on tonight's program. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And next month, Tate Hurwitz will be our speaker talking about science literacy, which is clearly an important part of this conversation. Thank you again to everybody.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.